Welcome to the Bald Move TV Podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for all the TV. I'm Jim.
And I'm Aaron.
And Aaron's got a lot of stuff he wants to talk about this week.
It's kind of a busy week, just for television news that I'm interested in and also for some stuff I've been watching. I don't know how much time we'll have to get to all of it. First thing I want to talk about, we both saw Netflix's Spoiler Vault.
Sure.
So if you're not familiar with this, and I'll post a link in the show notes, Netflix, I think it was Monday or Tuesday, posted this thing where you could go to a page and it looks like there's a big steel door with a big red button on it. It says press to be spoiled. You push that button, the steel doors slide, and it goes into the Netflix archive and shows you between a 10 and 30 second clip of just a massive spoiler. Like, it's going to spoil Kaiser Soze in The Usual Suspects. It's going to...
Yeah, it's not a single spoiler from, like, the same thing over and over again, or, like, a supercut or anything. It is a random... It is a spoiler from a random film or TV show or something.
Another real example that I think is fairly safe to say is Ginny Gump dying in Forrest Gump. Another similar magnitude would be Darth Vader.
Soylent Green is people.
Soylent Green is people.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, and someone said that there's only like 25 before they start repeating. I don't know that that's true or not. Mm-hmm. You know, I spent a good bit of time and saw some repeats, but also it's like just really some weird stuff, like a fourth season from some random WB episode, you know, series on witchcraft or something, which I had no, but. My question is, you know, with so many people being kind of spoiler phobes, what is Netflix's game here? Why are they doing this?
Oh, I think it's clear when you look at kind of the other half of this experiment, which
so,
is...
So talk about the other half, because I've completely ignored that piece.
You go into this other section of the website where you're basically helping them populate their database of what is and isn't a spoiler by being presented with a question or a piece of information from a film, like a line that says, I don't even know how you would do it with Soylent Green. Like, it wouldn't actually be Soylent Green as people, but it would be something close that, like, hints at what movie it is and hints at the spoiler
itself.
It's super
cryptic to where if you knew what the movie was, you would understand what they're talking about. But if you didn't, you'd have no idea. I'm trying to think what would be Charles Heston finds out the horrifying recipe for a snack, a mass-produced snack.
Yes.
That would be a good example.
Then you would know exactly what they're talking about, Soylent Green. And then it asks you to say, is this spoiler okay to talk about?
Yeah.
Yes or no? Basically, is it old enough to where everyone should have... Or is it relevant
enough?
It says
something.
Is it pop culturally ingrained
enough? The two buttons are too soon and old hat.
Yeah, but it's not necessarily a recency thing for me, at least when I'm doing it. When I'm doing it, I'm like, does enough of pop culture know about this to make it not really a spoiler anymore?
Sure, that's a good point. Like, so, obviously, Darth Vader, Luke's father, that is the hoariest of spoiler. Like, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
If you're just like, no! Well, you know, there's another spoiler for you. A lot of
newborn
people do that
infants everywhere crying out and suddenly silenced.
So, okay, you say it's obvious. What the hell are they doing? But you're, it's
I
obvious
think
what
they're doing is they're deciding what spoilers to show you in that spoiler, that random spoiler section.
Okay.
I think that's what they're doing.
But why are they doing the spoiler section?
At all? I don't know.
Because I don't know. Other thing is one of the spoilers specifically around Breaking Bad is Major League, and it's from the final season, which is just now a year old.
Yeah.
I feel like that would be way too soon, yet it's on there. I mean,
They warn you a couple of times. You have to click a couple buttons to get into that. So I think, you know, if they're showing the old spoilers, those aren't spoilers, and that doesn't apply to that section. I think they're actually taking the spoileriest of spoilers, the ones that people click too soon on, and showing those.
See, I wonder if there's not a little bit more a cultural experiment, because right now there's this extreme respect for people's not spoiling people, you know, and it's like one of the fucking worst first world things you can do to someone mm-hmm. is just drop a massive spoiler without context when you know that they're watching it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, you know, it can get to absurd levels. Like, I remember, I think in the third season of Portlandia, they had like an illustration of a dinner party where every single topic of discussion was like, spoiler, no, I'm not there yet. No, no, it's like some people, I feel like, take it too far.
Well, that's super interesting that you bring up that scene from Portlandia, because that is the problem with Netflix wrapped up.
And this is what I'm thinking.
And presented to you with a bow. Like, I've seen episodes 1, 2, and 3. You've seen episode 8. She's seen episode 6. How do we even have a conversation?
I wonder if this is Netflix testing out that cultural assumption. People say that, oh, I can't stand spoilers, and it's all, oh, you've ruined it for me. But when push comes to shove, what do people actually do? Because you're right. This is really wrapped up in their buffet model, you know?
Sure.
If you're I think it's fascinating because I don't give a shit. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like if a spoiler is such that it ruins a movie for me, then the movie wasn't that good. Because my favorite movies and my favorite things, I like to watch multiple times. Why do I like to do that?
Yeah, I think there's something about the original experience being unspoiled.
Certainly.
That is, I mean, once you're spoiled, you can't get that experience.
Sure.
You lose the opportunity for that. So, like, I'm not going to spoil this, but The Red Wedding, for instance, was massively spoiled for me. Mm-hmm. I knew exactly what was coming. It wasn't shocking.
It's
at
arguable
all when
that
it happened.
Using that term is a spoiler in itself.
I disagree.
Okay.
That's like saying that Charlton Heston movie.
I don't really give a shit. It was
with,
two seasons ago.
The crazy recipe.
Yeah. And I don't really give a shit because it was two seasons ago. I was spoiled massively for it. That's what led me to reading Game of Thrones, because I was just minding my own business and I saw someone, you know, toss off that term, and then someone explained it, and it's like, fuck, well, might as well read the books.
Yeah. But that ruined, you know, a good chunk of my enjoyment of that scene.
Okay.
So
interesting. Cause I don't know that it did for me. And I just wonder if this is again, like I said, a laboratory experiment where they're like, you say that you are this phobia of spoilers. We're actually going to put it to the test. We're going to see whether or not you really mean that, and we're going to do it in a way that we can precisely measure.
Yeah, it's interesting because they only present this, they only develop this feature if they disbelieve the idea that spoilers are a big problem for people in the first place, right? Because if you think that they're a big problem for people, you don't put the development effort into building something you think people won't use.
Right.
Like, specifically will avoid.
Right.
So they probably have the opinion that spoilers aren't that big a deal. What they also could be doing is using it for their marketing. Like, how much of the shows that we have can we get away with showing in our previews for other shows? Kind of like HBO Go does, where they have, you know, promos for their other shows. There's all sorts of ways. Netflix is they are data whores in the most positive way. They base, like, House of Cards and Orange is the New Black, their original shows, on what people are watching.
Mm-hmm.
They have empirical data to say these will probably be popular. So I think they have a myriad of ways that they could use this data.
I think there's one other possible potential reason they're doing this, which is to surface some of their deeper content. Because there was a couple, I think there's two or three scenes without context. I was like, whoa, that's crazy. And my girlfriend and I, who were watching this on the couch, were like, we want to jot that down and kind of check into that. Or I would those things would never have been on my radar elsewise.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, you know, and I feel like, you know, the Breaking Bad spoiler, that thing was so compelling that if I had managed to avoid watching Breaking Bad at this point, I'd been like, whoa, shit, I need to see that.
I wonder, maybe they're preparing for, like, a second screen experience as well. I don't know. There's so many ways they could use this.
But it is a thing. I'll link it in the show notes if you want to. But, I can't stress enough. I did this on Facebook, and, like, you know, 77 people liked it. There was 50-some comments, and there was 3 or 4 people like, I don't know why I clicked on this.
Yeah.
I wish I hadn't.
Yep.
So be warned, you know,
they
warn
you.
And it's addictive, too. Like, you're going to get, like, the first three will be like, oh, OK, well, I knew about Ginny Gump and I knew about Kaiser.
I've never heard of any of these.
Right. Yeah. Or these, and, like, but then you'll find one that's just like, oh, maybe I shouldn't have seen that. So,
yeah, like a show you wanted to watch. but hadn't got around to.
Super clever. Second thing I want to talk about is True Detective casting/news. It came across that it was confirmed that Colin Farrell and Vince Vaughn were locked up in two of the lead roles for True Detective.
Oh, boy.
That led me to just spending a whole afternoon finding as much as I could about True Detective. And there's a surprising amount of stuff in there. Yesterday, it was confirmed that Rachel McAdams is going to be cast as the female lead.
Okay.
Now, one thing, and I guess Taylor Kitsch is another guy that's a mention for the, you know, that's like all but confirmed, I guess, for the fourth lead.
I don't even know who that is.
Yeah, I'd heard of him. I wasn't sure exactly. I know he was in Battleship. He's in Friday Night Lights. He's just some young, kind of hot dude.
All right. I don't know what to believe here. There are so many rumors going around right now. I have heard.
Oh, he was John Carter from John Carter.
Okay, I don't think I ever saw that.
Yeah. Not many people did.
Nathan on Twitter said that Ellen Page and Kate Mara are for True Detective, and I have not heard that anywhere.
You said
Rachel McAdams. I guess I saw that on news sites and stuff.
The women that I've heard attached are Elizabeth Moss.
Long time ago, yeah.
Peggy Olson from Mad Men. Obviously, I think she would be fantastic.
Sure, she's just a fantastic actress.
Rosario Dawson.
Okay.
Was rumored to be attached to it. I love Rosario Dawson. Yep. She can play a lot of different things. Jessica Biel, I do not see at all.
No, you're not a Total Recall fan?
Oh, yeah. But
I didn't like Total Recall.
I was going to say.
It was a ridiculous film. But
yeah, and I mean, like, did that really sell you on Jessica Biel?
But that was both of them, right? Because you see them back as a pair, Colin Farrell and Jessica Biel together
again
in one long action scene. Holy shit. It's True Detective Season 2, people.
I mean, I know she's Justin Timberlake's mirror, but I think you need a little bit more. Keira Knightley was also attached. I thought Keira Knightley would be very interesting. Did you see the movie Domino?
No.
You know, so she plays this, supermodel / bounty hunter in that, and she's really tough and that kind of.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a stereotype.
Yeah.
That's just a cliche at this point, the supermodel bounty hunter.
Well, I mean, I think one of the annoying stereotypes where you got the elfin pixie who also is a total ass kicker.
Sure. It's becoming a stereotype.
Like River Tam.
Yeah,
you know,
and taken to like the nth degree in Kick-Ass, where the little girl is the badass.
I mean, it's kind of can be cool if you do it in the campy way.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know Michelle Forbes?
No. Does she own the magazine?
No. She played Ensign Ro Laren, like the first Bajoran we ever met in the Next Generation. And she's done a lot of other things. Most recent thing I've seen her in, I think she's in Season 2 of True Blood. She played the Maenad. She was in The Killing. I think that she especially is very good at playing kind of this aloof, dark, mysterious, but she can also play, you know, mischievous as well. I think she'd be good.
Interesting. Okay.
But I think we get Rachel McAdams. I say Rachel McAdams, first thing you think of is
Mean Girls.
Second thing you think of?
Dunno.
Okay. I know she's in Wedding Crashers. She's in A Family Stone.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
She was in, what's the last thing? Oh, Time Top, Traveler's Wife.
Yeah, she was pretty good in that. And I say pretty good. She was good in that.
All right. Well, I found a character, like a one or two line description of the characters that these people are going to play. And I wonder if this will make us feel better/worse about it. Ray Velcoro, who is going to be played by Vince Vaughn, a compromise.
We've talked a lot about the female leads. We need to talk about these fucking male leads, man.
Right.
Colin Farrell and Vince Vaughn. Oh, God.
Yeah, I think might have. Okay, this is by Colin Farrell. Ray Velcoro, a compromised detective whose allegiances are torn between his masters and a corrupt police department and the mobster who owns him. This is a lot like, it sounds like the, you know, the Marco Ruiz character from The Bridge.
Yeah.
Colin Farrell. You know, I think Colin Farrell's fine. I've seen him in a lot of goofy stuff.
Yep. I've seen him in stuff like The Recruit, though, where he's pretty good.
Right.
But he has a surprising range. Like, when I saw him in like Phone Booth and The Recruit, I was like, okay, you can do action, like serious drama action stuff.
Super expressive face.
But then you go to stuff like Horrible Bosses.
Sure.
Where he's just playing these outrageous characters, and he's got a lot of range.
Indeed. Frank Semyon, a career criminal in danger of losing his empire when his move into legitimate enterprise is upended by the murder of a business partner, to be played by Vince Vaughn. I'm guessing that this is the mobster that owns the previous detective.
Uh-huh. So they're trying to up their game from episode 4 where they did that one long shot. Now they're going to do a whole episode as one long sentence.
Just fast talking 90 guy sentence.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so I feel like Vince Vaughn is the only one I'm super worried about. I'm kind of surprised Rachel McAdams. I like her, but I don't know if she fits the True Detective mold. Honestly, don't know what the True Detective mold is.
Right? That's the real question.
Which we'll talk about here in a bit. One thing that when I posted this on Facebook, a lot of people were commenting and mentioning stuff that they saw Vaughn in that they thought was really good. Like one Nicole F. said, you should check him out in Domestic Disturbance opposite of John Travolta. That's the first movie I ever saw him in, and I thought he was a great villain. Kim L., said, I'm surprised no one mentioned Vince Vaughn as Norman Bates. Have you seen the Psycho remake?
I haven't, no.
So I wonder if I kind of heard that the Psycho remake was terrible, but you often get that when someone remakes a classic that doesn't really need to be remade.
Sure.
And then Jonathan C. said, you should check out the movie Clay Pigeons. It's a bit sinister, but he also has a weird charm in there as well. So I guess that if you're concerned about Vince Vaughn, there's your homework assignment. Find out Clay Pigeons, check him out in Psycho, check him out in Domestic Disturbance, and see.
I don't like Vince Vaughn as a human being.
Yeah.
There's like a base level kind of creepy vibe I get from him. But I also have only really seen him in comedies. So it's hard for me to judge how he's going to hold up dramatically.
Not seeing these three movies that they mentioned, peak Vince Vaughn is Vince Vaughn and Swingers.
Okay.
He's really good, but that does not fit what I conceive True Detective at all. And then I've also seen him in, like, you know, Wedding Crashers and Dodgeball and all that other crap where it's like, what? And he's kind of the more I see him, the more he's kind of just like lazy Vince Vaughn.
Yep.
You know, it's like that's kind of what you get. It's kind of the same way that Harrison Ford is kind of just plays Harrison Ford now. He doesn't give a fuck about what he's supposed to be doing. Al Pacino doesn't give a shit. He's just going to be Al Pacino.
Yeah.
That's the one that's got me worried the most.
Yeah, maybe he's trying to change his image. Maybe he's refocusing, getting serious, trying to do some cool dramatic stuff now.
Jake M on Facebook said, I'm less concerned with Colin or Vaughn, but more concerned with Justin Lin directing the first two episodes.
I don't know who that is.
Justin Lin is the director of the last three Fast and Furiouses.
Oh, Jesus.
Does that really scare you, though?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm of the opinion that Fast and Furious, the last couple ones, are actually kind of awesome.
They're awesome, but I don't know that I want True Detective to be awesome, you know? Mm. Like, I want it to be interesting, and I want it to be kind of quiet, and Fast and Furious is not any of that.
At least
that's my expectation given season one. I don't know what to expect in season two.
There was a guy on Grantland, I think it was Alex Papademos, that was talking about this very thing, about Justin Lin and you know, people being concerned about it. And he said, while he's perhaps best known for directing several of the Fast and Furious films, I believe a more apt touchstone for his work is the 2002 directorial debut, Better Luck Tomorrow, which focuses on a group of Asian American friends in Los Angeles who become involved in crime, drugs, and a general lifestyle of excess. It's a bracing film, one that feels hyperkinetic and pyrotechnic even without the future Lin trademark, such as car chases, blowing shit up, etc. Another thing I'll say about Lin is he implicitly understands the collective imagination's look and feel of California. It's a mixture of glitz and sleaze, shine and grime, and while the films he has directed have largely been popcorn fare, there's an atmosphere to his films that is intoxicating. And that is relevant because Nick Pizzolatto, I think that's how you pronounce his name, is said that Pizzolatto has said that he's setting this in Southern California.
Okay.
And not like the L.A. parts, like the outside L.A. parts, more rural
deserty
parts.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So And the one thing that concerns me about True Detective, because the first season was so amazing because it had one writer, had one director, they had a clear vision, they stuck to it, and it was really great. Plus, it was something I hadn't quite seen before. I mean, it's kind of a really interesting experiment the way it worked that way. You've already got, you know, this guy's turning this thing around in less than a year. I don't know how long he polished True Detective. I presume he had years. But then he is going to turn around in less than a year, and now you're splitting it up amongst X many directors. Do you think that that has a potential of losing some of the specialness that season one had?
I think it definitely has the potential to do that. It's harder. Like, I don't know. I mean, it depends on how cohesive of a series you're actually looking for, but it's, you know, the director position in filmmaking is a very important one. They are the vision. And if Nick Pizzolatto is not, is he writing all of this at least?
Yes.
Or does he have a team of writers?
As far as I know, he's writing the whole thing.
I don't know. It takes a lot of skill for two or more directors to have the same, kind of get their visions in line with each other. And I'm a little more scared about that than I was about season one. So I don't know. I'm worried on all sides. Actors, setting not being as interesting, you know, multiple directors and writers and all that stuff.
It does have a potential to be kind of like House of Cards, where David Fincher came in and directed the first two, I think, and kind of set the visual look of it.
Yeah, or Boardwalk Empire.
Same deal. And then everybody else kind of goes along with that style, and it feels pretty fairly cohesive.
Yeah, and I hope that's what happens. Just harder to pull off.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm super worried. I mean, I don't know why, because if season two True Detective sucks, it doesn't take anything away from the first season.
No, but you know, you want more of what you got
sure.
in season one. So.
Sure. The other thing I got sidetracked is the third character, the Rachel McAdams character, is Annie Bezerritis, a tough, no-nonsense Monterey sheriff whose troubled upbringing has driven her to gambling and alcohol. And again, I don't know if Rachel McAdams is confirmed or what, but that's like, she's a lot more confirmed than she was 24 hours ago.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know. I mean, I don't know that she can play that, but then I never saw Elizabeth Shue playing the character she does in Leaving Las Vegas until I actually saw Leaving Las Vegas and wanted to kill myself.
Yeah.
I mean, Elizabeth Shue, like depressive, suicidal, destructive, dark. I just, you know, she was Adventures of Babysitting, and she was the eye candy in The Saint, and, you know, one of my first teenage crushes. And so you just never know.
Sure. That's why acting is acting, right?
Indeed. Anything else you want to say about True Detective before? They do. So it initially was rumored as like the week after the season ended. I think we talked about this on the wrap up cast. Nick Pizzolatto said that it was going to explore the surprisingly occult backgrounds of the American railway system.
Okay.
And since then, he's revised it and says it's going to be more about the dealings of the highways, like the real estate dealings and the business dealings and the business of making the highways in Southern California. And people have speculated maybe Route 66 plays a big part of this.
Mm-hmm.
But it's going to begin with a murderer being found with a satanic symbol carved on his chest.
What does that have to do with highways? Come on.
I don't know. I mean, I guess it'd be like if someone said, you know, a satanic cult around a rural school system or around the faith-based school system in Louisiana. You'd be like, what? But that is True Detective, season one.
What is True Detective? What is True Detective going to be? Is it going to be a fantasy series where the occult is kind of hamstrung in or kind of wedged into different scenarios? Is that what True Detective is going to be? Is True Detective going to be something very different every season? Like, because the occult is firmly planted in season one.
Sure.
if you now take that and you say, okay, building the highways had nothing to do with the occult. Building railroads had nothing to do with the occult, but we're going to put it in there, and that'll make that more interesting. I don't know that I was – that is what I was on board for. Like historical – like revisionist Nazi history type stuff.
So the political connectedness of the occult stuff going on in Louisiana did not float your boat.
No, it kind of did, because Louisiana has a little bit of that
kind of weird, like, voodoo
doctor sort of rep feel to it. Sure. Like, this is very, like, spiritual side to the city itself, whereas Southern California doesn't feel that at all, right?
Hmm. I don't know. It says another quote I found in the rap says it's about a corrupt California city manager who's found brutally murdered amidst a potentially groundbreaking transportation deal that would forever change freeway gridlock in the state. It's going to feature three police officers coming from different cities and branches of government who must finger the culprit.
Okay, that doesn't say anything about the occult.
Well, but the brutal murder involves the city manager is found with a satanic symbol etched on his chest. That's okay. Where the occult comes in.
Yeah.
So I guess I don't understand what you mean
Satan
about.
What does Satan have to do with building the highways in California?
What does the Yellow King have to do with faith-based schools in Louisiana?
But that was like a purely fantastical story. That was a fiction. Now we're talking about blending
fiction
and reality.
Maybe Route 66 was originally Route 666.
Oh, Jesus.
And Vince Vaughn saved the day at the last moment.
I could totally see
that. By winging a volleyball at some dude's head. All right,
I'm back in. I'm back. You can dodge a highway. You can dodge a ball.
So that's the kind of True Detective news. I'd love to hear what people think about this. You can email us at tv@baldmove.com. One in on a couple of recommendations that I've consumed in the last couple days. This weekend, the Jay-Z and Beyonce On the Run tour, that's something that's been going on all summer long. HBO had like a 2.5 hour. It was a whole concert from the beginning to the end.
Yeah.
And it was fucking awesome. It was great.
Can you explain this to me? Is this wrapped up in the like 30-second partial videos of Beyonce that I saw throughout like the last 5 months on
HBO? Leftovers. So before each Leftover episode, the Leftovers episode, they had a single song from the Beyonce Miss Carter tour.
But was it the whole song? It wasn't like the whole song, was it?
No, it was usually the whole song.
Huh, okay.
It was like 3 to 4 minutes, and it was from the Miss Carter tour. Her and Jay-Z both had just wrapped up worldwide tours, and then they decided to go on tour again, only this time is going to be them together.
Yeah.
I thought it was fucking awesome. And the thing is, so I'm a huge Jay-Z fan. I know you're a huge Jay-Z fan. I'm a pretty big Beyonce fan. I know you don't probably give a shit.
No, the album that she released recently, where it's just, you know, her kind of doing what she did, fuck the labels. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. And it was all visual in nature. And this tour is very visual. The thing that surprised me is when Jay-Z was on, because they kind of, number one, I've forgotten how many fucking collaborations they've done in the last 10 years. Like, way more than I would have thought that they've actually been on each other's tracks. And they kind of do, like, they open up with the, you know, Bonnie and Clyde's stuff and upgrade you to shit that you'd expect. And then, you know, Beyonce kind of takes it for like 20 minutes or so. And then Jay-Z comes, they'll do another collaboration as a way to kind of like the DJs mixing two tracks together to fade back into Jay-Z. And they kind of do that all night long. What really surprised me is when Jay-Z was on, I found myself start playing with my phone, because 100% of what I was getting from Jay-Z was through my ears. Like, he was just really just standing there. And as it's a single guy standing in different outfits, doing different hand gestures. But that's it.
Yeah, that sounds like a rap concert to me, sure.
Well, Beyonce is on, the fucking phone dropped, and I was just mesmerized because the audio-video assault and all the dancing and the choreography and the fact that she can just, like, Tina Turner-esque do this shit while she's belting out tunes without lip-syncing is amazing.
The fact that she looks like Beyonce as well.
That doesn't hurt. She's a very sexy woman. She knows how to move the body. But I'm just saying, like, she does really intense.
She's giving you a show. Yeah. Whereas Jay-Z is giving you a song.
Yeah, there's very few people that can do that choreography and not lip sync. Like, you're not getting that from the Britney Spears and the, I don't know, Katy Perry's of the world. But it's really good. Very. If you got HBO Go, you can watch the whole damn thing in really glorious high def. It's a great way to spend 2.5 hours if you are at all inclined to listen to their music.
I am. I'll check it out.
The other thing, you turned me on to a documentary a couple days ago, and I watched it last night.
Yep.
It's called In My House. No, it's not called In My House.
We're going to have to look this thing up. How I Live My Life or something like that. The House I Live In.
The House I Live In. That's what it is. It's by a guy I'd never heard of, but he's done a couple other documentary films. It has a shit ton of David Simon in it.
Yep. Who everyone knows is the creator of The Wire.
The creator of The Wire, The Corner. He's both the book and the series. And I just... Like, I thought I was fairly educated about the war on drugs, because obviously I pontificated about it at length. But this thing is a very tight 2-hour documentary. It's not sensational. It's very calmly and rationally from all sides, from the police side, from the judicial side, from the government side, from the street level side, black, white, poor, rich, prison industrial complex. It just lays out why the war on drugs is eating away at our country.
Sure.
And it's interesting because, good documentaries can really, make people sit up and take notice. Like, look what Blackfish has done to SeaWorld.
Sure.
Like, SeaWorld is dying because they have this massive PR problem because someone made a documentary that clearly logically lays out what brutal inhuman treatment that's being perpetuated on an intelligent animal.
Yeah.
And everybody gets up in arms about it. Blackfish, their page on Facebook, has millions and millions of hits. I remember when I watched it the first time last year, I posted on Facebook. I had a dozen of my friends and family like, yes, I saw that. And, oh, it's terrible and all this. The House That I Live In has currently 20,000 likes on Facebook. And when you want to talk about the oppression of intelligent beings, you might want to start with your fellow human ones.
Yeah, I think that's a good place to start.
Possible to watch this show and come away thinking that justice is being done in any of these communities it starts off, you think it's going to be like, oh yeah, it's another one of these things about the black community and all the shit that's going on there. But halfway through the movie, they pivot into like how really meth and what it's doing to the poor white communities
is the exact same deal. And now people are just pissed because it's happening to the white people. Oh my God, it's happening to the white people.
But they're not. No one's pissed because it's happening to the poor white people.
Yep.
Like, there's this one really moving story of this guy who's put away in life in prison because he was arrested with 5 grams of methamphetamine.
Which, when you're talking about, like, mandatory sentencing stuff,
yes,
that's where this stuff gets really nasty because take like, crack and cocaine, for instance.
Right.
Crack is a form of cocaine. That is mandatorily sentenced at 150 times.
It's 100 times.
100 times the rate that cocaine is. So basically meaning if you have 5 grams of cocaine in your pocket, that is equivalent to 500 grams of this other, of crack.
And the judge I thought was brilliant because I didn't know. But crack cocaine, he's like, do you know what the difference in crack cocaine and powder cocaine is? They mix it with baking soda and water and they cook it.
Yeah.
There is no, it's actually, it's actually less pure than powder cocaine.
But here's the reason why it's such a problem. It's because primarily the black community, the poor black community were the ones using crack cocaine, whereas the Wall Street crowds were using cocaine.
Right.
And so the sentencing is entirely unfair and ends up with the vast majority of people affected by it being poor black people.
You know, and the other thing is that I thought that the movie did really well is they show just decades of politicians saying the same goddamn thing about getting tough on criminals, of taking the war to the streets, about putting away the dealers and the pushers and the people that are killing our children, and then showing the stats on drug use, and it has not changed.
Yep.
Like $1 trillion has been spent, and our incarceration rates.
Think about this. We are the highest currently in the world.
Yep.
Right? There is no other country with more people incarcerated per capita than us.
Not Saudi Arabia.
Not China.
Not China. Not North Korea.
Right?
We rule the world.
Insane. Now think about this in a historical context. This is the most imprisoning country in the history of the world.
Right.
Never has there been more people in a country, in an empire, imprisoned than we have right now.
And there's, you know, it's like one of those things where I just didn't know what to do. Like, I've already kind of worked up about the war on drugs. I think everyone knows.
Sure.
But, like, watching this thing was just a gut punch, but also kind of hopeful because you see how many prison administrators, how many law enforcement officers, how many judges, how many politicians are finally starting to, like, I don't care if this costs me my career or costs me my election or whatever. I cannot sit and say we need tougher punishments on criminals. In fact, we need to start rolling this shit back.
Yeah, it's hopeful, but it's also scary because the end of that, near the end of that documentary, they show, you know, the prison industry.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the scary part because now you're talking about big business with political lobbying going on and tons of money to spend to keep this industry alive.
Right.
Keep these laws from changing. That's the scary part.
And there's whole towns where your the local factory, the local manufacturing base, the local job creator is a huge prison.
Look at Detroit. Detroit's a perfect example of this. You lose the steel and car industries.
Right.
And boom, your whole city. It doesn't matter how big the city is. Your whole city's going under. And a lot of these small towns and even bigger towns are supported entirely by the prison there.
And when someone wants to close them down, it's like this big thing. And when you build...
And people actively protest not to close down the prison. It'll put us out of jobs.
And when you build... Like one prison administrator made a brilliant point. When you build a facility with 25,000 beds, you must fill that.
You gotta fill them.
Or you've sold this bill of goods to the community that, you know, we'll buy the land and you lease it and we'll all get rich. Well, if those beds don't get filled, and some of the stuff that, like, the CCA, if you look at their marketing materials, they, like, put as a bullet point, like, why you should invest in CCA. Well, they put it right there. America has the highest rate of incarceration. We have the highest rate of recidivism. And it's like a marketing point. We put more people in prison. We do such a shitty job training them to equip them for life on the outside world that they're going to be right back in. So this is the safest investment you can make.
It's fucked up.
It's crazy.
But the thing is, they take none of the risk, right? Let's say, you know, the prison population dries up. We pass some crazy law that or we repeal some crazy laws that cause less people to go to prison. Now that population's drying up. Well, they've just leased the land. They haven't built the buildings. They haven't put all that infrastructure in place. Now those towns are stuck with these massive buildings and infrastructures that they have no use for if the prison goes away. So it's
a self-perpetuating thing.
Yeah. The thing I really like about this documentary is that it's not sensationalist, right? I've seen a lot of these things where they'll take one or two people and they'll follow their stories and they'll say how unjust it is that they got arrested for having cocaine in their car or something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not really the unjust part, right? It's the sentencing part. It's all of these things. They focus on the wrong things and they try to sensationalize the story of a couple of people.
Mm-hmm.
Here, I like how they just take the stories of the people. They present them in context with what's going on in the industry and the culture. And they don't try to, like, make a huge deal out of just these two stories and say, this is how everything is. No, they take you through it and they show you logically why these things are a problem.
And he goes all over the country and shows, like, you know, what – and the other thing that he makes, I think, a really good point, and David Simon does too, is just what this does to United States police force.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like, just how this is destroying entire generations of cops and making them incapable. Like he said, it's like you got a whole police force that can't solve fucking crimes.
Yeah.
Because the reward is to go out and, you know, bust low-level street stuff, get a whole bunch of overtime, filling out paperwork, taking guys to prison. You know, you solve a rape, that takes weeks, and you might clear one case.
Sure, and you're not getting the overtime.
Yeah, you look at the sergeants are the guys making 60 arrests a week versus the guy – who's actually doing something that's helping society. It's great. And like I said, I feel like I might be – the reaction I had to it is one of sadness and anger, but it's not a sad or angry film. It's very matter of fact, and it's just – it's kind of like, you know, it's a very
– it's thought-provoking.
Yeah, kind of – I mean, you know, it's like the similar feeling I get when I watch Schindler's List.
Mm-hmm.
Like, wow, this is – and only this is actually happening, and it's all real life. I encourage anybody that's into The Wire or is curious about how we can make our country better is to check out The House I Live In. I'll put the Facebook page. You can get it for free on Netflix. It's available just about in every damn where that stream shit. So check it out. That's all I got. You got anything you want to say?
No, I think I'm good.
All right. If you'd like to send us feedback on this podcast, you can do so at tv@baldmove.com. We'll probably be back in a week or two, whenever there's news or something to talk about.
All right.
We'll see you then.